with what is QCD, what is described, why study a space diagram. So very introductory questions. So what is QCD? If you someone gives you the Lagrangian of QCD, you would think that QCD is not very different than electrodynamics. In electrodynamics, we have fermions, the electrons, interacting by the exchange of gauge bosons to photons. In QCD, we have fermions, the quarks, interacting by the exchange of gauge bosons to gluons. It's true that the quarks come in six flavors, but that happens, so what? And at the level of Feynman diagrams, it also seems like it's really just adding one more diagram, this other difference, which is that in electromagnetism, all electrons have charge minus. In QCD, quarks can have red charge, green charge, or blue charge, and the gluons can change their color, so that means that the gluons carry color, and so can be exchanged also. As you presumably know, this difference, although it looks just like a technicality, if you look at Feynman diagrams, if you think non-perturbatively, if you think more sophisticatedly, it has a very important qualitative consequence. In any quantum field theory, whether QED or QCD, you should think of the vacuum as a medium which can screen charges. It's not just empty. It has fluctuations which can be modified in the presence of charges and thus affect the properties of a charged particle. And in QED, the way this works is that as you look at an electron on shorter and shorter and shorter distance scales, the effective charge gets larger because you're probing inside the screening cloud. In QCD, it turns out that as a consequence of that other diagram, if you probe a quark on shorter and shorter and shorter distance scales, its effective charge gets smaller. QCD is asymptotically free. The flip side of that is that QCD is strong interacting at long distances. And as a consequence of those strong interactions, if you ask, what does QCD describe? There's no such thing as electronics with currents of quarks flowing, or laser beams made of gluons. It's an experimental fact that in the world around us, quarks and gluons occur only in colorless packages, which look quite different than the fundamental objects in the Lagrangian. And a way of saying this is that these hadrons, so-called hadrons, the protons, neutrons, pions, kaons, and their friends, are the quasi-particles of the QCD vacuum. They're what we're made of, and they look very different than the quarks and gluons that are the fundamental objects occurring in the Lagrangian. So this really is the central challenge of QCD. QCD has been known as a theory of the strong interaction since the early 70s, so why do we still study it? It's the only example we have in the theory of matter, the theory of nature, of a strongly interacting gauge theory. It's the only example we know. There may well be others in nature. It could be that as when we go to the LHC and start to probe the properties of matter at shorter distances, maybe we'll find that the W and Z bosons are actually composites. Maybe instead of the Higgs boson on the standard model, we'll find composite objects. So there could well be other strong interaction dynamics in nature, but the only one we know of is QCD, so we better understand it. And we do understand it at short distances, where the coupling is weak. But at long distances, the quasi-particles, the excitations of the vacuum, do not look at all like the short distance degrees of freedom. And this is really the challenge to understanding what QCD describes. And one way of responding to this challenge is to study the hadrons. To do deep inelastic scattering off those hadrons and understand their structure. And the other way of responding to this challenge is to try and look for other phases of the theory with different quasi-particles, so to get away from the vacuum. It's been speculated since the discovery of QCD, really, since 1974, the year after asymptotic freedom was discovered, people have asked the question whether QCD might have other simpler phases. If the vacuum is so complicated, maybe there are ways of finding phases of QCD that are simpler. And the argument, the naive argument going back to the 70s was that quarks and gluons are weakly interacting when they're close together or interacting at high momentum transfer, so that suggests to look at high densities or high temperatures, maybe QCD simplifies. Now, the lesson from condensed matter physics is that this 1970s hope is naive. You think about it, in condensed matter physics, we have a gauge theory. In a reductionist sense, all condensed matter physics is quantum electrodynamics. And so the fundamental coupling is 1 over 137. And yet we have solids, liquids, gases, ferromagnets, antiferromagnets, superfluids, superconductors, an extraordinary rich phase diagram where the fundamental coupling is 1 over 137. In QCD, as you go to higher densities and temperatures, you'll push the strong coupling down in value. QCD will get more weakly interacting. but you'll never get it as weakly interacting as 1 over 137. So there's every reason to expect that as we study the phase diagram at QCD, it will turn out to be as interesting as condensed matter physics, not just the 1970s naive hope that, well, go to higher temperatures and everything will become simple. So what I'm going to do here is describe the status of our understanding and lack thereof of one region of this phase diagram. This phase diagram is drawn as a function of temperature on the vertical axis and density, actually chemical potential, on the horizontal axis. The region on which I will focus is this region up here, of high temperatures, temperatures above the crossover to the Quark-Gluon plasma phase, which is now being explored by experiments at Brookhaven. Before I do, though, let me just say that there are other regions of interest in the phase diagram. If instead of heating hadronic matter, you go to high densities, you get superconducting phases. This would be the subject for another day. Out here, we understand the physics at very high densities and low temperatures rigorously from first principles. This is a very well understood region of the phase diagram now. And the challenge here is to come to these intermediate densities where the centers of neutron stars may lie. And if you check out my publications on the archive, you'll find my current thoughts as to what may happen here and why it's interesting for pulsars in my most recent paper on the archive. So if you want to read about this, I just told you where to look. On the vertical axis, we now know from lattice QCD, as I'll show you in a minute, that there's a crossover from a gas of hadrons to a Quark-Gluon plasma. And presumably at very, very high temperatures, that Quark-Gluon plasma will be the 1970s simple phase. But what we're learning from heavy ion collision experiments is that this region of the phase diagram, just like this one, is interesting and challenging and not just a naively coupled phase. So we'll come back to this phase diagram at various times. Let me now rotate this again. I guess I need an image to see what I'm doing. There we go. Neat trick. So let's now talk about what we know on the vertical axis of the phase diagram. So think about taking the QCD vacuum and heating it up. You get a gas of hadrons. You heat it up some more. And there's a crossover. QCD, we described a crossover from a gas of hadrons to a plasma of quarks and gluons. We know with 10% accuracy what is the temperature at which this transition occurs. We know that this transition is a smooth crossover. We know these things from ab initio theoretical calculations done with very large computers. And just to give you one snapshot of the kinds of things you get from those calculations, here is a sort of pedestrian way of seeing that QCD describes the deep confinement transition as a function of temperature. There are more sophisticated ways of getting at this in lattice QCD, but this is a very nice, simple way of thinking about it. You calculate the energy density over T to the fourth. Now, what is that quantity? If you have a relativistic weakly interacting gas, the energy density is a number of degrees of freedom times T to the fourth times pi squared over 30 or something like that. So energy density over T to the fourth counts degrees of freedom. And what you see here is that this number of degrees of freedom rises dramatically by more than a factor of 10 in quite a narrow range of temperatures. Note the suppressed zero on the horizontal axis. And then flattens. And to decide what we should think this phase up here is, this high temperature phase, you can compare this to the epsilon over T to the fourth of the ideal Quark-Gluon plasma. So just literally doing what I said, count degrees of freedom and multiply by pi squared over 30. And you see that it's not far off. We'll come back to this not far off in a minute. But what you see from this phase diagram is a crossover, because there's no discontinuity on this axis, occurring in a narrow range of temperatures from something which is a gas of hadrons to something which we call the Quark-Gluon plasma. And now the question is, what are the properties of this Quark-Gluon plasma? So
can you compare that to n squared?
Well, the n squared, of course, unfortunately, in the lattice folks, for reasons that I don't understand, always calculate with n equals 3. There's very little lattice calculation with n's other than 3, and there's no reason why they couldn't. It's just because it's hard. It takes time. But in this ideal Quark-Gluon plasma benchmark here, it is set to 3. And this ideal Quark-Gluon plasma benchmark rises like n squared with n.
This is a lattice calculation.
Yeah, it is.
Couldn't it convert what was really a phase transition into a crossover?
This is the subject for another day, but it's very well studied, not just with cartoon version like this, but doing real finite size scaling analysis, and it is a crossover. But you can't tell that. You're right that you can't tell that just from looking at this.
So just one more question. Normally, the quantity is a number of degrees of internal degrees of freedom of each particle. It's not a number of particles. It's a number of degrees of freedom.
Yeah.
Internal ones.
That's right.
Do you think it's like 10 to the 10? That's
what's 10 to the 10?
The number of internal degrees of freedom.
No. I don't know. Where is 10 to the 10 on this?
Well, it's better to see.
No, this is not a log scale in the vertical axis. It's a linear scale.
Okay.
You have to do the pi squared over 30, but it corresponds. This benchmark line corresponds to 47.5 degrees of freedom, which is the right number for QCP. Okay. So, given a phase diagram with a crossover, if you're an experimentalist, there's no yes/no question to answer. It's not a matter of saying have I or have I not made the quark-gluon plasma. There's a continuous crossover between quark-gluon plasma and gas and hadrons. So the goal of these experiments, which I'll talk about for the next few minutes, I understand that Brian Cole was here last week, so I hope I can go a little bit quickly through my discussion of the experiments. The goal of the experiments is to create matter that's above the crossover and study its properties. And that's a simple phrase with three parts. The most subtle part of it actually is the word matter. What I mean by matter is matter that's behaving collectively. It's matter in the sense of condensed matter physics, not just a bunch of particles non-interacting with each other. Matter which I can describe with thermodynamic phrases, with, you know, notions like pressure, temperature, entropy. And what you should already have heard from Brian and what I will talk about for the next few minutes is that rigged data on a quantity called V2, which I'll explain in the next transparency, tell us, as I will explain, that the interactions are sufficiently strong to yield approximately equilibrated matter, expanding collectively, behaving like a fluid, so really matter, not just a bunch of particles, by time about one Fermi after the collision. And one Fermi is a small time. One Fermi is the time it takes light to cross a proton. So it's a rapid time. So the interactions are strong, equilibration occurs rapidly. And after that time, an ideal hydrodynamic description in which you make the brutal assumption of zero mean free path seems to describe the physics of the bulk of the particles, the low momentum particles, quite well. So I'll say more about this in a minute. Well, is that matter above the crossover? It's actually a very unsubtle, straightforward analysis from the data to show that at the time of one Fermi after the collision, the energy densities are bigger than 5 GeV per cubic Fermi. I won't even talk about this anymore. It's straightforward. The subtle question, so if you say, where is 5 GeV per cubic Fermi on this diagram? It's right about there. So if you can show that you have equilibrated matter, then the energy densities correspond at this point on this curve about one Fermi after the collision. But to know that you can even use this diagram was calculated for equilibrium QCD. So the subtle thing from the point of view of the experiments is to ask, can you really show that you have matter as opposed to independent particles? The way that you make this case is to study what's called elliptic flow. And the idea here is you look at a sample of events in which the two nuclei at RIC collided not head on. So up there in the cartoon, there's a gold nucleus going into the board, a gold nucleus coming out, and they collided with each other at a non-zero impact parameter. That means that the collision occurred really in that red almond-shaped region only. And so if the hypothesis you want to rule out is that the only thing that happens in that red almond region is lots of, say, proton-proton and proton-neutron and neutron-proton collisions, each one of which makes a small spray of particles, and after that, just free streaming. So no interactions, just a bunch of lots of independent PP collisions add them up. If you had that, then if you had 100 PP collisions in that red region, it doesn't matter that they're in that red region. If the particles don't talk to each other, you'll have an azimuthally symmetric final state just by the law of large numbers, that central limit there. On the other hand, suppose that it's reasonable to say that I have a hot fluid in that red almond, so that all the stuff I've made is interacting with each other and can be described as a fluid. Then that red almond, another way of describing what I have is I have a shaped charge. In the study of explosives, if you want to make an explosion which blasts with greater force left and right than up and down, you shape your explosive like that. And the reason is that when you ignite the explosion, the pressure is highest at the center, so the pressure gradients, and it's zero at the edge, excuse me, so the pressure gradients are bigger left and right than up and down, so you get a bigger blast left and right than up and down. So if you get to think about this red stuff hydrodynamically as a fluid, then you should get a non-zero, azimuthally unsymmetric final state. You measure the azimuthal asymmetry, it's called V2. It's a straightforward measure of azimuthal asymmetry. You find that it's not zero, then you have to compare to something. So the red dots are data, the black bars are theory. The theoretical benchmark which you compare to is hydrodynamics. In hydrodynamics, you make the completely ridiculous assumption that local equilibrium is maintained beginning at time zero. And it's very important to stress, for people who haven't seen this before, that hydrodynamics has been tried in heavy ion collisions for decades, and it never worked before RIT. For example, at older experiments at CERN at lower energies, the asymmetry in the data was about half that predicted by hydrodynamics. So at RIT, for the first time, hydrodynamics actually does a good job of describing this asymmetry. And these authors translate that into a statement that hydrodynamics has to be working by a time of around 0.6 to 1 Fermi. It's very easy, actually, to understand why this agreement means that hydro has to work early. If you take that red almond, have a bunch of PP collisions in it, and let every particle, assume you have free streaming for 5 Fermis, then say this almond might be 5 Fermis across and 10 Fermis up and down. So if you let it free stream for 5 Fermis, it's become almost circular. So just by geometry, you can see that if you get the V2 that hydrodynamics predicts, it means that interactions have to be important long, long, long before 5 Fermis. And then you do it more quantitatively, and you get this estimate.
How long does this hydrodynamic approximation continue to work?
Until a time called freeze-out, which I'm not going to talk about, but it's probably, it's the time at which, so you cool through the transition, and the freeze-out is the time after which you just have independent pions flying outwards. It's the freeze-out temperature is somewhere around 100 MeV at RIC, so that's 100 over 170 in units of TC, so it's well below TC. So you stay in, approximate local thermal equilibrium well through the transition. So probably order 10 Fermi, I would say. If the temperature is better understood than the time. So another thing you can do with this, the fact that hydrodynamics works, another thing you can do with this is to use it to constrain the shear viscosity, because ideal hydrodynamics has no shear viscosity. So what Derrick-Teeny did was to stick in a shear viscosity and ask how much of a shear viscosity can this comparison tolerate? And a way to benchmark the shear viscosity is to take the shear viscosity, the ratio of shear viscosity to entropy density, and that turns out to be not well constrained yet, but less than order 1/10. It's less than or of order 1/10. So, well, is that small? Hydrodynamics is named after a fluid called water. Okay? If you ask what is 8 over S in water, it's about 10. So what we learned from Rick is independent comparisons to theory, this Portnoy plasma is more hydrodynamic than water by about a factor of 100. So is this a surprise? Well, the first answer is no, this should not have been a surprise at all, because we're only at a temperature of a few times TC. And at a temperature of a few times TC, of course, the interactions are strong. But the reason why people were surprised by this is that people were seduced by this plot to make the following erroneous assumption, or draw the following erroneous conclusion. When you see energy density over T to the fourth, that's about 80% of ideal gas. Ideal gas means no interactions. And without thinking about it, many people inferred, therefore, that interactions are at 20% correction. And once you start to think about it when provoked by the data or by the theory that I'm about to describe, that's erroneous, because how do we know where this curve would be in the limit of very strong interactions? All we know that is if there were no interactions, it would be here. But where would it be if there were very strong interactions? And this is where This other gauge theory called N equals 4 supersymmetric QCD comes in for the first time in my talk. This is a different gauge theory. It's not QCD, but it too has a strongly interacting quark gluon plasma. And various authors last decade showed that the energy density over T to the fourth of this quark gluon plasma is 75% of its value, of the value that it would have in the absence of interaction. And more recently, Andre and friends showed that when the interactions are very, very strong in this theory, this ratio 8 over S is 1 over 4 pi. So this, too, is a liquid with a lower viscosity for entropy ratio than water. And the 8 over S ratio for the quark-gluon plasma is comparable to that in this theory. So a posteriori, in other words, after the data, it's not surprising to find a quark-gluon plasma liquid. The picture we now have is you start with a gas of hadrons. They probably turn into a liquid of hadrons, although that's not well studied. You then get to a quark-gluon plasma liquid. And ultimately, at some much higher temperature not determined, you'll get the 1970s gas quark-gluon plasma phase. And also a posteriori, in this case after Andre and friends, we realized that energy density over T to the fourth of 80%, which is what lattice QCD told us. Lattice QCD told us that in real QCD, the energy density over T to the fourth is 80% that of a non-interacting gas. Well, 80% is closer to 75% than it is to 1. So the contribution from N equals 4 is to realize that in the limit of infinitely strong interactions in this other gauge theory, that horizontal line would be about there. You can see that the actual horizontal line in QCD is much closer to the line I just made than to the ideal gas line. And this is really the first contribution of this N equals 4 other gauge theory to understanding the quark gluon plasma in QCD. The 8 over S is the second.
Should be worried that the line doesn't seem to be rising. It's just not a
logarithmic. It presumably is rising logarithmically, but you can't see a logarithmic rise if you go only up to 3.5 TC. It's a very interesting. That's a very interesting question, which I could come back to afterwards. Okay, so but there's more to heavy ion collisions than V2. What I want to talk about next is the other striking experimental result from Rick, which is called jet quenching. I've so far been talking about the bulk of the particles, the hydrodynamic flow. But once in a while, and occasionally in a Rick collision, and the occasional in rare collisions, you have a hard scattering. So right there, there was a proton collider with a proton that made two very energetic quarks going back to back, or there, or there, or there. And the picture that is suggested by the data is that you only see, so if you have a proton-proton collision that makes two back-to-back energetic particles, you get two jets. You get two sprays of particles going out like this. And the picture that the data suggests is that you only see a jet if that particle collision occurred near the edge and if one of the particles was going outwards. In other words, you see a jet here, but then you look at 180 degrees and there's no jet. So let me just show you this in data. Did Brian already do this?
Yeah.
He should have. So here's the data with Brian probably already showed. You trigger on a high energy particle coming out at you, and then you look in azimuth relative. So there's one particle coming out at me, and I look in azimuth relative to that one particle and say, where are the other energetic particles? You find there's a cluster of them near the one you triggered on, and a cluster at 180 degrees. That's two jets back to back. And that's true for proton-proton and proton-gold collisions. But in heavy ion collisions, gold-gold, the backward-going jet is quenched. This was the discovery plot, really. You can then do this better with more recent data. You can see, for example, that momentum is conserved. What you see on the backside is not nothing. What you see is an enhancement of soft particles. So there was a jet that was going that way, but instead of coming out as a jet, it's turned into a slight excess in the soft. In the amounts of quark gluon plasma, if you like, going down. So you really have, this is another way of seeing evidence for thermalization, in this case, thermalization of hard particles. You can do really clever things like these people did. You can combine the two kinds of data that I've described so far, and you can look at the suppression of the backward-going jet in this geometry or in this geometry. And you can see that if you identify the orientation of the collision, You should expect more suppression for the red geometry than for the blue geometry, and that is what you see. So it really is, the picture, the cartoon picture really is backed up by a whole host of data. And to summarize what is to come, so I'm going to summarize where I'm going before I go there. The quark-gluon plasma at RIC turns out to be surprisingly opaque to hard colored partons. And if you ask from a theoretical point of view, how do you calculate the energy loss of a very hard quark trying to fight its way through the quark-gluon plasma? You can actually compare this at only at the qualitative level to the question that you can find in Jackson. Suppose I have an electron going through matter. How does an electron lose energy going through matter? You can go read in Jackson, and you find there's different regimes, different processes. But if you go to the highest energies, the answer is Bremsstrahlung. And the same is true in QCD. At the highest energies, the dominant way that a quark, trying to get through the quark-gluon plasma loses energy is Bremsstrahlung, in this case, Bremsstrahlung and gluons. So the process you should think of is a very energetic quark, which is radiating a gluon, and both the initial quark and the radiated gluon are continually being slightly jostled by the medium. That's the physics of energy loss in the high energy limit. And if this picture is correct, in other words, if you are in the high energy limit, then this diagram is sensitive to the medium only through one parameter. It's sensitive to the medium through a parameter that tells you how much jostle does the medium provide. So how much momentum transfer squared in the transverse direction is picked up by a light-like particle as it's going through this medium. So this one parameter has the unfortunate name of Q-hat. I have no idea why people named it that. It's just life. And this Q-hat is extracted by comparing RIC data to theoretical calculations. And it comes out to about 5 to 15 times larger than suggested by weak coupling calculations. So there's a problem here. So let me say what I just said again, slightly more completely. If you calculate the gluon radiation spectrum due to this diagram, you have to take this diagram, take its modulus squared, and in the limit of large distance traveled, the answer turns out to be proportional to this parameter, the square root of this parameter Q hat for gluon radiated gluon energies that are less than Q hat times the distance squared. Q hat, as I said, is momentum transverse squared picked up for distance traveled. This calculation assumes that the energy and the transverse momentum of the radiated gluon are all much, much larger than the temperature. At RIC, this is a little bit of a dodgy assumption, because at RIC, the highest energy jets we study at RIC are about 20 GeV. Each gluon radiated presumably it has to be less than 20 GeV. And if you put in the numbers, you're talking about radiated gluons with 2, 3, 4, 5 GeV. That's larger than the temperature, but not a lot larger than the temperature. At the LHC, this is all going to get much more quantitative, because at the LHC, we'll be studying 100 GeV jets shooting through quark-gluon plasma. It's not 20 GeV jets. So the intuitive understanding of this parameter is that, well, how often, if you think of a weakly interacting medium, you shoot a hard particle through it, ask how much momentum transferred squared does it pick up for distance travel? Well, that's easy. What's the mean free path? And what's the amount of kick I get in each collision? So if you can think of it in that way, with a weakly interacting picture where you have rare collisions, then Q hat will be the momentum transferred per collision squared, that's mu squared, divided by lambda, the mean free path. And in a weakly coupled scenario, Q hat is a measure of the number density of scatterers. It's a measure of the, what's the spacing between scatterers, basically. And it also involves a dimensionless measure of the strength of the interaction. So now you extract this from RIC data. What does that mean? Well, there's a fair amount to it. But to give you a sense of the quality of the extraction, which at present is qualitative, not quantitative, I wanted to show you this one plot. One of the ways of extracting it is to calculate how many fewer, say, pions should you see with momentum 15 GeV than if you just had a bunch of independent proton-proton collisions. The reason there are fewer pi zeros with momentum 15 GeV is that many of them got quenched. And what you see here is that in the data, which is the open circles, there's about 20% as many pions with PT of 15, so let's say 5 to 20 GeV, than expected in the absence of any quark-gluon plasma. So there certainly is jet quenching. And now you do a calculation with Q hat of 1, 5, 10, and 15 GeV squared per Fermi. Q hat is dimension 3. And you see that 5, 10, and 15 all work. But you can also see that the error bars are big. There's a lot of scatter. This is still early days. The LHC will make this a lot better. But roughly, what you extract is that Q hat is 5 to 15 GeV squared per Fermi. So, well, what can we compare to? What Hong Liu and Boris Biedemann and I did was to realize, well, everybody knew that there's nobody knows how to calculate this Q hat in a strongly interacting QCD quark gluon plasma. It's a very dynamical quantity. It's not suitable for a lattice calculation. So we calculated it in N equals 4, the same theory that Andre and friends showed had a shear viscosity that seemed to be close to that at Rick. So we went and calculated Q hat in this other gauge theory, in the strongly interacting limit, and we get an analytic result. There it is. And we learned two things. First of all, we learned something qualitative. We learned that in this quark gluon plasma, Q hat is not proportional to the entropy density, the number of density of scatterers. In a quark gluon plasma, if you really had a weak coupling picture, the number density of scatterers grows like nc squared, as Ami was asking about a minute ago. And Q hat here does not go like nc squared. So we've already learned that strongly interacting quark gluon plasmas, their Q hat cannot be thought of using weakly interacting intuition. Then you try plugging in numbers and things get even better, although this might turn out to be a coincidence. What I just said is will last forever. And the interesting fact, which might yet turn out to be a coincidence, is when you plug in numbers, what's the number of colors in QCD? Well, that's 3. What's alpha in QCD at Rick? This is a standard baseline used for making comparisons to data at Rick. It's, of course, not quantitative. What's the temperature at Rick? This is a reasonable estimate of the temperature at a time of 1 Fermi. Actually, in fact, if you want to get more precise, you could have used 270 instead of 300.
That's a lot for alpha. Why is it so large?
Because you're only at a temperature of 300 MeV.
How was this determined?
Poorly. Poorly. We could talk more about that. Let me just say poorly. But so you plug in these numbers and you get something which is in the ballpark of what the data requires. In contrast, if you do the same exercise at weak coupling, so do the weakly coupled calculation, you find that Q hat goes like nc squared, as I promised. It goes like alpha squared. You plug in numbers here using the same numbers to make the comparison fair, and you get 1/5 this. So a coincidence or not, that's, in a sense, the remainder of my talk I want to explore. You know, it's a very strange strategy as a theorist. You're interested in the quark gluon plasma of QCD. You're doing calculations in the quark gluon plasma of the wrong theory. Why are we doing this?
Were you also using the ADS-CFT?
Yeah, I'm coming to that. I'll talk about it. I'm going to tell you how we do these calculations in a minute, but let me talk about, you know, why it's not a... I'm going to get at this from different angles in the rest of the talk. So one way of thinking about this is that nature only gives experimentalists one quark gluon plasma to study, namely QCDs. But as theorists, one way that we can learn about the properties of quark gluon plasma is to study it in a whole host of theories, not just in QCD. We're not restricted by the fact that we only know of one strongly interacting gauge theory in nature. We can study many more. This is in many ways the spirit of condensed matter physics. In condensed matter physics, when you want to understand metals or ferromagnets or antiferromagnets, it's very, very helpful that we know many, many examples. And so we can understand what are the characteristic defining common properties of a metal. It's those things that you can describe with Fermi liquid theory. And what are the details that don't matter? It's microscopic properties of the crystal structure. So by studying other examples in which calculations become tractable in the limit of strong coupling, what we're trying to do is to understand what are the defining and common characteristics of strongly interacting quark gluon plasmas and what are the details. The way you do this is you do two kinds of calculations. You can calculate static or thermodynamic quantities. And those you can compare to lattice QCD. So you calculate them in these other theories, compare them to what we know from QCD on the lattice. And now there are a few examples of dynamic properties which you can determine from experiment or constrain from experiment and calculate in these other theories. And so if the quark gluon plasma at RIC is a liquid, then lattice QCD is fine for studying its thermodynamics. But there are no good theoretical tools for studying its dynamics in the presence of strong interactions in QCD. So the real power of ADS-CFT is that it's a calculational method that is best when interactions are strong. So I'm now going to describe to you a little bit about this N equals 4 theory and how one does these ADS-CFT calculations. We now have two examples, this shear viscosity and this Q hat, which are calculated in fact in infinite classes of strongly interacting quark gluon plasmas. And in both cases, they agree better with RIC data than weak coupling calculations in QCD do. So we have this strange situation where you have two choices. You can do the wrong calculation in one of two ways. Either stay in QCD but do a weakly coupled calculation, or stay with strong coupling but use the wrong theory. And it turns out that staying with strong coupling and using the wrong theory agrees better with data for these two quantities. Okay, so, what is this other theory, and then how do we calculate with it? So this other theory is supersymmetric. So I want to enumerate the differences between this other theory and QCD. It's supersymmetric, but, well, I don't care about that, because supersymmetry is badly broken at zero temperature, at non-zero temperature anyway, so that's not so important. But it has the wrong number of degrees of freedom. If I define the number of degrees of freedom as I did before by the ratio of energy density to T to the fourth with a pi squared over 30 in there, then in the N equals 4 theory, that number of degrees of freedom is 120. In QCD, it's 47.5. So you need observables. For example, you need to find ratios in which this difference cancels. And we'll talk about how to do that for Q hat at the very end. Now, there's another important difference, and that is that N equals 4 is a conformal theory. There's no scale in it except temperature. And QCD is absolutely not a conformal theory. If you look at QCD at low temperatures, it has as many scales as there are hadrons. It's filled with scales. So N equals 4 is a horrible model for the vacuum of QCD. But in a regime of temperatures which seems to start at around 2 TC and goes up to some temperature which is not yet really well determined, it turns out that the quark gluon plasma looks reasonably conformal. I already showed you that the energy density is proportional to T to the fourth. Another property of a conformal theory is that the speed of sound is 1 over root 3. If you plot speed of sound squared versus temperature in QCD, you find that by about 1.5 TC, it's very close to 1 over 3. There are many other indications that in a range of temperatures above TC but not infinitely above TC, there are no scales in QCD other than the temperature. It's forgotten about confinement. It's forgotten about the properties of hadrons. So maybe the strongly interacting quark gluon plasma can be well modeled by a conformal theory, even though you can't use N equals 4 to describe the Rho meson. Finally, these calculations are done in two limits. They're done assuming large number of colors. They're done assuming 1 over nc squared is small, and QCD 1 over nc squared is a ninth. They're done assuming large coupling. It turns out that the relevant thing that has to be large is g squared nc. In QCD with alpha of a half, g squared nc is 19. So you have to believe that 1 ninth is small and 19 is large. And you should not, in the end, have to believe that. You should be able to check it by calculating corrections. And that has been done in some cases, but not in others, as we'll come to. So what is the tool? The tool that we use to do calculations in this other theory is this ADS-CFT correspondence introduced by Maldacena and friends. And what they observe is that this gauge theory, it's a four-dimensional gauge theory, has gluons and gauge fields, and fermions, and scalars, is equivalent to string theory in 4 plus 1 dimensions and plus 5 curled up dimensions. We'll ignore the 5 curled up dimensions, but one of the things that I want to do in the rest of this talk is to explain how a theory in 4 dimensions can be equivalent to a theory in 5 dimensions. There's a mapping between the two parameters that specify the gauge theory, namely G squared and NC, and the two parameters that specify the string theory, namely the string coupling constant, and this ratio of ADS curvature to string tension. And finally, if you want to study the gauge theory at finite temperature, you introduce a black hole in the fifth dimension. So how does this all work? For me, it's easiest to understand this with an example. So I want to talk about one of the simplest calculations you can do in ADS-CFT, or for that matter in QCD, and ask how it works, how does it work? So suppose I wanted to calculate the force between two very heavy quark and anti-quark pair. The way I would do this in QCD, QCD lives in 3 plus 1 dimensions, which is this black plane here, is I would build a big computer, and you can calculate in lattice QCD the force between this quark and this anti-quark, and it is a very, it's an enormously complicated computational problem, but one which is now well addressed using teraflop scale computers. And what you're doing is you're computing the gauge field fluctuations in the vicinity of this quark and this anti-quark, and asking and determining the force between them. In contrast, in this five-dimensional theory, in this ADS-CFT correspondence, the calculation is much easier. What Maldacena and friends tell us is that another way of calculating the same thing is to think of this 3 plus 1 dimensional space that we live in as the boundary of a fifth 5-dimensional space, and the quarks and anti-quarks are the ends of strings which hang down into 5 dimensions. There's a force of gravity in this fifth dimension, because this fifth dimension is called an anti-de-Sitter space. That means there's a curvature. So there's a force of gravity that pulls the string downward. And all you have to do is to extremize the shape of the string, solve the catenary problem for this gravity field. It's just like solving the catenary problem in undergraduate mechanics, except in an unusual gravitational field. And why is this the right thing to do? Why is string theory so simple here? It's because of these two limits. The large coupling limit corresponds to the large tension of the string, so this string is not fluctuating. If you didn't take that limit, the string would be fluctuating. And the large number of colors limit corresponds to the small string coupling limit. That means there's no loops trying to break off here. So if you didn't take these limits, then you would still, according to Maldacena, have an equivalence, but it would not be of practical utility. But in these limits, you do an undergrad calculation and then differentiate the energy of that string relative to separation to get the force, and you can do it. In fact, I have taught undergrads how to do this calculation. It works. And it's much, much easier than lattice QCD. How does confinement arise in this picture, or how can confinement arise? Well, if you separate the quark and the anti-quark, if, as you pull them apart, that string in the fifth dimension behaves like this, then you can see that if this is how the string behaves, the force between the quark and the anti-quark pair would not decrease as I increase it further, as I separate them further and further. You can also see that I've just introduced a scale, namely this scale right here. So this can't be what happens in a conformal theory. So to have a description of QCD with confinement, you need something like this to happen. But in n equals 4, this is not what happens. In n equals 4, the shape of that red string, if you separate the Q and the Q bar, the shape of the string stays the same. So you can't describe the vacuum of QCD in this way. But you can describe deconfinement. What happens in the n equals 4 theory when you turn on a temperature is you introduce a black hole horizon down here at a different location in the fifth dimensional space than where we live. You can think of this like a little furnace down here. And as you now pull the Q and the Q bar apart, at some point, instead of having a U-shaped, topologically U-shaped solution, you don't anymore. The only solution you find is a string descending down to the horizon. And now, as you pull the Q and the Q bar farther and farther apart, there's no change in energy, so there's no force. So the force gets screened at a screening length L sub s. This can be computed very easily. It was done in the late 90s, and it's about 0.3 over the temperature. And in QCD, you do this much harder calculation with what big computers, and you get something which is agrees with that within a factor of 2. So this would just be a curiosity, because this is a quantity that you can calculate in QCD. You don't need this technology for it. But what Hong and Worsen and I did was to make a very slight modification of this calculation, which then yields something which no lattice calculation can ever do. And that is, we said, well, let's let the quark and the anti-quark move through the plasma. We then calculated the force between a quark and an antiquark moving through this plasma. Nobody knows how to do that calculation in QCD, yet it is the experimentally relevant quantity, because when you make a QQ bar pair in a heavy ion collision, it will in general have a relative motion with respect to the quark gluon plasma rest frame, the local rest frame. What we find is that this screening length decreases like 1 minus velocity squared to the 1/4 power. In other words, like 1 over the square root of the Lorentz gamma factor. And what this suggests is that the dissociation temperature for mesons, so if I think of this QQ bar pair as a proxy, as a very crude way of describing a meson, remember these are infinitely heavy, but so it's a crude description of a meson, then if the force between them is zero, the meson is unbound. And the screening length decreases with velocity, and that means that the dissociation temperature decreases with velocity. And so, what do we know from experiment? A third strand of the experimental story is one called is the physics of J-psi suppression. This is a long story which I'm about to grossly oversimplify. The J-psi is a CC bar pair. It has a set of states, much like positronium. There's a ground state, the 1s state. Then there's the 2s and the 2p states. All of these are very well studied in vacuum. And we know from various experiments that when you see a J-psi meson in an experiment, 40% of the time what was actually made was one of these, which then decayed to the J-psi. 60% of the time you made from the beginning a J-psi. Also, these guys are more tightly bound than these ones. These are bigger and floppier. They are larger, so they will get dissociated at a lower at an earlier temperature. These, to dissociate these, you need less screening than to dissociate these. This is calculated on the lattice, all of the mesons at rest. The dissociation temperature for these is about 2 TC, and for these it's 1.1 to 1.2 TC. And then you ask about the data, and I won't show it. And the message from the data is that both RIP and the SPS, you get a yield of J size that's between 100% and 60% what's expected. And in other words, it's consistent to hypothesize that these guys are melting at RIP and these guys are not. Okay? This is a model interpretation of data. It's not. There are other ways of trying to describe J-psi mesons. As I said, it's a long story. But if that model interpretation is true, then our result has the following implication. Our result says that the dissociation temperature, which is 2.1 TC at zero velocity, will drop with velocity. If you translate that into transverse momentum, which is what the experimentalists observe, it says that suppose RIC is at 1.5 TC, which is a good estimate. Then all the J-psi's, not just the ones that were made through the higher states, all of them should go when you get to transverse momentum about 5 GV. So we have made a prediction that when experiments are done, which allow you to look at J-psi's with PTs bigger than about 5 GV if the RIC temperature is as currently thought, or 9 GV if the RIC temperature is lower than currently thought, you should see a further drop in the J-psi, in the J-psi production. This is, to my knowledge, the first prediction from string theory. Although, as I've stressed, this prediction is based on two legs. One is our calculation, which began from these string theoretical considerations, and the other is a model interpretation of current data. So it's not quite literally true that we made a prediction only from string theory. But I still think it's a very nice development. So I walked you through how to calculate the force between a quark and an antiquark, and then I went from that to a prediction for experiments to come. Earlier in the talk, I described results for two other quantities, Q hat and eta over S. Q hat turns out to boil down to a similar calculation. Again, an undergraduate can do it. It's also a catenary problem. It's a catenary problem with slightly different boundary conditions. If this were a seminar, I would spend a half an hour describing how to do this calculation, but I will not in a colloquium. Eta over S, Andre was the first one to calculate. It is not analogous to the calculation I've described, but it is something you can hear about from Andre. But just to tell you, it does not boil down to a catenary problem. So I've given you some sense then of where these results come from. Let me now, for the rest of the talk, return to QHAP, which is the case where we're comparing to existing data rather than making predictions for data to come. So we got this perhaps coincidental result that the QHAP we got from calculations in n equals 4 supersymmetric Yang-Mills theory is in rough agreement with that obtained by comparison with data from Rick. So what are the issues on both sides of this comparison? The extraction from data is done. It's not as though experimentalists measure QHAP. There's no QHAP meter that they have. Okay? They measure various observables, and then they compare them to predictions for how those observables depend on transverse momentum obtained as a function of QHAP. And this comparison is based on the assumption that gluon radiation is the dominant mechanism of energy loss. And we know that that's correct in the limit of high energy, but it may not be correct at Rick. This is the biggest fly in the ointment on the experimental side of this comparison. And this will improve in a couple of years when the LHC turns on. There are a lot of different ways in which the LHC will be able to do this much better. So hopefully with data that will be taken about 2 years from now, so maybe in 3-4 years, some experimentalists can come and say we've extracted QHAP, and we'll be talking about something with an error of 20% rather than saying from 5 to 15. Well, what about on the other side of this comparison? How can we go from the QHAT of the supersymmetric Yang-Mills theory towards the QHAT of QCD? So I'm going to describe to you the current state of play in this business. Hom and Urs and I have one result, which is a step in the right direction, but it's only one of the necessary steps. What we have shown is that if you calculate QHAT in any conformal theory and compare it to QHAT in n equals 4, the ratio of these QHATs is the square root of the ratio of their entropies. That again tells you that this weak coupling intuition, which says that QHAT should be proportional to entropy density, is wrong. Furthermore, you can then make the bold guess that QHAT in QCD, this is a result, this is a guess. You can make the bold guess that QHAT in QCD over QHAT in n equals 4 goes like the square root of the ratio of their entropy densities, which is the square root of 47.5 to 120. So in other words, we have now a conjecture for how to treat the fact that these two theories differ in their number of degrees of freedom. And the result then is that QHAT in QCD would be reduced from that in n equals 4 by about 60%. Well, that's one thing you'd like to correct for, changes the number of degrees of freedom. But what about non-conformality? QCD is non-conformal. So Alex here has the nicest result in this domain. What Alex showed is that if you compare two theories called KW and KS, they stand for people, but it doesn't matter who they are. It's Klebanov-Witten and Klebanov-Strasser. But two theories, this one is conformal and this one is not. They're related to each other in a way that Alex could explain. The non-conformal theory has a QHAT, which is different from the conformal theory. And you can parameterize the difference by looking at the deviation of, this should be speed of sound squared minus a third, excuse me. If you stick in a speed of sound squared, as in QCD at a temperature of 1.5 TC, you find that in this case, which unfortunately is not QCD, but in this case, the degree of non-conformality that is characteristic of QCD reduces QHAT by 15%. So what you would like to do is to have other examples. And in particular, again, this is a plea to Alex, who's not in the room. It would be very, very helpful to calculate QHAT in Alex's favorite non-conformal theory, which is called n equals 2 star. This would give us another handle on how to understand the implications of non-conformality. Finally, on the wanted list would be redoing this calculation in examples where the Quark-Gluon plasma includes fundamental degrees of freedom in addition to adjoints. I'll skip that for those of you who are not familiar with this notion. And obviously, we've done the calculation in two limits. G squared nc goes to infinity and n squared goes to infinity. You'd like to calculate corrections to this. There's been progress here, no progress yet to report there. So all of this is just a few months old in the case of the QHAT story. So let's suppose that, say, a couple of years from now, on the same time scale as the data gets better, suppose that after calculating QHAT in many and varied gauge theories with dual descriptions, suppose we understand enough to conjecture that we know Q hat and QCD, that we know this coefficient B here. Suppose we believe that we knew it at the factor of 2 level. I think actually we're not, that's not unrealistic. I don't think we're there yet, but I think I can imagine doing calculations in enough theories that we get a sense of how things change as we change the theory to get a factor of 2 understanding. This would have a huge impact on the subject of NDI and collisions, because that means that Q hat is now a thermometer. And it's a thermometer with a calibration uncertainty of just 2⅓. And there are no other thermometers in heavy ion physics. If I go back to this very beginning, what you would love is to measure both the energy density and the temperature at a time, one Fermi after the collision. If you knew energy density and temperature, you could check whether you're sitting here at 12. But nobody knows how to measure the temperature at a time of one Fermi after the collision. You can measure the temperature of the final state, but not the temperature of the quark gluon plasma. So this would be of enormous value.
But how easy is it to measure Q hat?
That's what will get better as we go to the LHC. Right now, we have at best a factor of 3 understanding, but it will get better as we have 100 GV jets instead of 20 GV jets. I can explain more how it will get better at the LHC.
Is it a natural measurement?
Yes. It's not a first day measurement, but it's a first year measurement. Okay, there are other directions being investigated with ADS-CFT, including by some in this room. I'm out of time, so you should ask Andre to tell you about the calculation of the photon emission, for example. To end, right now, the two best studied strongly interacting quark gluon plasmas are that in QCD and that in this N equals 4 theory. I don't think anybody would disagree that those are the two best studied, although many others are now studied. So if we make a little comparison chart, the energy density, 3/4 of its non-interacting value in this theory, 0.8 in QCD. Pressure, 3/4 here, 0.8 there. Speed of sound squared, 1/3 in this theory. Above about 1.5 TC, it gets quite close to 1/3. Screening length differs by a factor of 2. Shear viscosity, 1/4 pi in this other theory, less than 0.1 in QCD. Q hat, 5 here, 5 to 15 there. Lots of caveats that I just discussed. Velocity dependence of the screening length, very simple prediction here. The data is yet to come. The data requires higher statistics to push out the higher transverse momentum. There are other examples. I picked one from the work that I just skipped, the fraction of the jet energy that goes, I won't talk about this. There are other examples which are under study. So, it's going pretty well, I would say. There seems to be a sense that the details of the microscopic degrees of freedom don't matter so much when you're in the strongly interacting regime. If you're in a strongly interacting regime, if you're in a liquid phase, there are no well-defined long-lived quasi-particles. Everything is in the collective behavior. And if you're in that regime, maybe it really doesn't matter whether you happen to have gluons only, or you happen to have a few colored scalars too, like in N equals 4 theory. So what is to come? A very biased selection. We will, in the next few years, be studying how higher and much higher energy quarks lose energy, probing the quark gluon plasma in a more precise way, extracting Q hat, and in fact other observables too that I have talked about with much greater precision as RIG increases its luminosity as the LHC runs. On the theory side, Alex and Andre and friends, I hope, we'll be calculating Q hat and other more QCD-like strongly interacting quark gluon plasmas. It would be way too optimistic to say you can calculate it in QCD using these methods. Nobody has a clue how to write down a dual description of QCD itself. But I think by approaching QCD from enough directions, you should be able to get a factor of 2 understanding, and that would be sufficient to really have made a big contribution to the science of this subject. Another thing, which I wanted to mention at the very end, just to tell you that there's progress coming in other areas of the phase diagram, there's a critical point here, we think. We believe from various theoretical considerations that this crossover actually becomes a first-order phase transition at a critical point at some non-zero density. And there's a very nice program of experimentation that's planned for about 2009, 2010, at RIC, which can only be done at RIC, not at the LHC, which is designed to look for signatures of this critical point in the phase diagram. That's another talk to explain in detail, but just to give you a sense that there's more to this phase diagram than going upwards, which is what the LHC will do. You can also go rightwards, and that's a very nice target for future studies at RIC. And I'll stop there.
This is a comment. It was a very nice prediction, but I don't know if I call it a prediction of string theory.
Yes, sir.
A prediction of ADS of some gravity dual model for the.
Okay. It's certainly not a prediction of string theory as a theory of quantum gravity.
Yeah, it's not, it's a theory of nature as opposed to a calculational technique or understanding.
Well, it's, well, one, the conservative thing to say is exactly what you said. ADS-CFT is a calculational technique. But, so without saying anything about quantum gravity, this has nothing to do with quantum, with, this has nothing to do with string theory as a theory of nature at the Planck scale. But somehow it seems that QCD is in some sense, which no one has yet put their finger on, close to being describable by a five-dimensional string theory. And you know, I think that's pretty cool. I mean, I don't know what. Pardon me.
It would be kind of ironic if string theory began as a description of QCD.
Absolutely. And what it shows is that you know, the mistake that a Hooft made, you know, the great man, he introduced the large N expansion, and he made the observation that large N seemed to classify diagrams in a way that was very reminiscent of the string theory, because, you know, the planar diagrams that went on a torus, et cetera, looked like these diagrams were little fishnets of string world sheets. You know, what Maldacena really showed is that the mistake it took made was instead of, was to not try and do, you know, Maldacena's work is intimately relies on large N. But the difference is that he was doing a five-dimensional string theory over here and comparing it to four-dimensional gauge theory, and it's a tough thing to do that. But yes, it is. My colleague, Martin Swebach, recently gave a lecture to undergraduates at MIT, title of which was String Theory, colon, Back to Its Roots. And it was about this.
Yeah, well, to go just a bit further, I mean, before Tuff, there were Tarkov speculations. And I wonder if something could be done from that, because I mean, what Kharnikov speculated was that there was a string theory in five dimensions dual to QCD, which was a non-critical string theory, and the purpose of the fifth dimension was to code the non-criticality, that is the scaling, the local scaling of the string. So now, what the data is saying is that, whatever that is, there's a regime of that where there's approximate scale invariances returned. And that's what I get from this.
Regime and temperature, yeah.
A regime and temperature where sort of surprisingly, there's a regime where things are scaling. And I do wonder if you took the insights that have been gathered from this and went back to Kharnikov's original idea.
And I'll leave that as a challenge to Jama, Andre, Ami.
This would go back to the critical study, not to the non.
Well, right, but supposing you want to go. I mean, somehow there's some generic thing which the n equals 4 supersymmetric theory is letting everybody calculate in, which is I sort of said it, but I mean, imagine that there is this thing which is the Pavlov-Kharnikov analog, which is the non-critical string theory, which is dual to QCD and is in five dimensions. And then you heat that up and go into the right regime, and that goes into some scaling regime. And that's what would be a more precise description of the experiment.
So I will say, by the way, I don't know. I don't think I have anything to. Well, I would love it if a speculation like that could be turned into a concrete concrete statement, and I'm going to leave it to the other people in the room. But let me just say, make a few comments about the reaction of this work. My observation is that the experimentalists in heavy ion physics love it, because they have been frustrated over the decades with the perturbative QCD as a rather weak crutch. And they're willing to listen, very much willing to listen to ideas coming from a strongly coupled description of another theory. Absolutely, no problem. Hebbian theorists bifurcate. There are some who are more receptive than others, but many are receptive. But the experimentalists just love it. And the string theorists that I've talked to anyway are thrilled by it also, because the grand goals of string theory will take some time to realize. This is really something where you can be having a tangible impact on a subject that includes experimentalists. So they're enjoying it. I think it's and the way it, I mean, I don't know how Andre could describe how he and Son and friends got started on this in Seattle 5 years ago, but at MIT, I can say how we got started. I mean, it started when Hong Wu arrived at MIT. He started from the beginning, from the day he arrived, he was coming to me and saying, you know, these Seattle people, Andre was a Seattle person, these Seattle people did this really cool thing with ADS-CFT, and it seems to be telling us something about the real world Borg-Bourne cloud, but can we find another quantity? It was actually Urs Biedermann who had the suggestion for what the other quantity was.
So you concentrated on the vertical axis.
Yeah.
But at the beginning you made a comment that if you went out on the horizontal axis, things became very simple. So can you expand on that? Why is that?
Okay. So I didn't say simple, I said well understood.
Normally you only understand simple things very well. It's better.
Okay. So anyway, this is not the Canadian Football League. So this is another talk, and I've given colloquy on this, and so I could talk for an hour, but I don't think you would appreciate that. But what happens when you go to very high densities, so you have quark-spilling Fermi surfaces. Now you think about one Fermi surface for each color and flavor of quark. And what Bardeen, Cooper, and Schrieffer ask you is, well, do these fermions attract each other? If there's an attraction, if there's channels in which there's attraction, then you'll get superconductivity. And it turns out that the attractive channel is anti-symmetric in color and flavor and spin. And if you anti-symmetrize, and so you get a pattern of pairing, so you get a pattern of a condensate of Cooper pairs in which the Cooper pairs are, say, red-green and red-blue and blue-red, and up-down, down-strange, and up-strange. And if I did it with equations, which somewhere I have probably, anyway, if I did it with equations, what you find is that there's an SU3 of color, an SU3 of flavor, and these Cooper pairs, these diquark condensate, breaks both, but it leaves unbroken an SU3 where you simultaneously rotate in color and flavor. You can cancel, and the effects on the condensation of a color rotation can always be canceled by a flavor rotation. So this is called color-flavor locking. This is now well enough understood to know that this is the phase of QCD at asymptotically high densities. If you go to high enough densities, when the Fermi momentum becomes very large, then these interactions are weak, and you can calculate. It's not perturbative, but it's weak coupling. All the answers are go like e to the minus 1 over a coupling. So it's not perturbative, but it is controlled by a weak coupling. This CFL phase has a whole interesting set of properties. All the fermionic excitations are gapped. Its transport properties are dominated by collective modes. But everything is under control, way out here. So the simplest phase diagram of QCD would be CFL all the way down to a transition to hadrons. And that might still be correct, but the reason why it might not be correct, the reason why there's something different that can occur here, is that the CFL pairing requires pairing between up and down, down and strange, up and strange. And as you come down in density, you start to notice that the strange quark is heavier than the other two. And the Fermi surfaces start to split, so now you have these spheres with different radii. And it turns out that BCS pairing doesn't like pairing between fermions with different Fermi momentum. And this crystalline phase is one possible answer, and the one that I would now bet on, but it's not as rigorous as out here. See, out here you can appeal to the weak coupling. Down here there's no weak coupling. It's one possible answer to the question of how does a system with paired fermions respond when you try and split the Fermi surface. I'd be happy to talk with you more about this. It's what I've been working on most recently, but I think I'd be trying the patience of the larger audience. Well, I'll just say this stuff is both rigid and superfluid, and that's what makes it interesting.
Okay, actually, there are more questions. Let's thank speaker.